When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello and welcome to the Wisden Cricket Weekly podcast. England have ramped up their T20 World Cup preparation with a win over Australia in Perth, one with Ben Stokes back in the fold. How do Liam Livingstone and Chris Jordan fit into the equation when they're fully fit? England have also released the next batch of central contracts with a few changes from last year. We've got a chat with Ollie Pope on the show that's included later on. We'll be doing a bit more T20 World Cup previewing, and we'll also be going over Cricviz's list of the best 20 men's T20 players in the world that's featured in the latest issue of Wisden Cricket Monthly. And we've got to get through all of that before Ben Jones has to catch his flight to Australia later this evening. I'm Yaz Rahn, and with me today is Cricviz analyst Ben Jones, the managing editor of Wisden.com, Ben Gardner, and Mark Butcher, who's with us in the studio for the first time in a while. Welcome back, Butch. When you were rubbing shoulders with Wazim and Wakar in Pakistan, was there a part of you that thought, oh, I really wish I was back in the studio with Ben and Yaz, hearing about how Ireland are doing in the World Cup Super League?
Almost entirely, yeah. especially when I started to get abuse for completely off my own bat advertising toothpaste, which was in no way part of the broadcast.
I have to say, I find the advertising on the Pakistan broadcast really charming. It's really fun. It is just the kind of like slight glance to the side. By the way, are you interested in a cup of tea or some toothpaste?
It is a lot of fun. It's even more fun when people take it completely seriously. And like, I mean, you know, if I was hawking the stuff off my own bat, then I'd be talking about, I don't know, Rolexes or Ferraris or something rather than random toothpaste, but there you go.
Anyway, central contracts. England handed out 30 contracts, 18 are full central contracts, 6 are incremental contracts, where players essentially get top-ups on their pre-existing county deals, and then there are 6 pace bowling development contracts. Quite a few talking points, players like Milan and Jordan, who are clearly in England's T20 plans, but not necessarily so in ODI cricket, have had their contracts downgraded. In Jordan's case, he's not got one at all. Jason Roy has had his downgraded. Ben Foulkes has his first full-time central contract, as has Liam Livingstone. Zach Crawley, who averaged 23 this summer, has a full contract. Alex Lees, who averaged 25, but does not have one of any kind. Butch, lots in there. What stood out most for you?
Well, I mean, there's a couple of guys who might think to themselves that they might have had a full contract, Harry Brook being one. I think the Crawley-Lees thing is, I mean, anybody who didn't see that coming is frankly a fool. Alex Lees, his sort of struggles at the other end went under the radar, basically, because Crawley was taking on all of the vitriol and opprobrium. But Lees looked increasingly sort of out of his depth. In fact, I hadn't thought he'd looked out of his depth until he started to try and play like he was David Warner. And then I just thought, well, sorry, mate, you can't do that. It's not part of your DNA. And therefore, that probably became apparent to the guys who were picking the team. And they thought, well, if we want to continue to play in this fashion, then I'm afraid there will be better people out there than Alex Lees at playing in that way. Which is a little bit of a shame on Alex Lees. I don't think he got a real chance to go out there and bat as himself, barring, of course, the West Indies trip where he looked terrified in the first couple of innings that he played, but then actually started to look okay. But once it was foot to the floor, pedal to the metal, then I'm afraid he was the one that was going to go. And Zach Crawley's sort of his charmed life continues. The final innings here at the Oval showing what he could do. And everybody knows, and everybody that's watched him can hear that sound of when he times something, when he hits it at the middle of the bat and he hits it harder than anybody in that England team. He's going to get another chance, another opportunity down in Pakistan on what should be very batter friendly surfaces, to go out there and put some runs on the board. It can't go on forever, but for now he's got the insulation of a central contract. Other than that, I think it's pretty much as you would expect it, with, I suppose, the only other one, the huge winner, the man who seems to win however much he loses, being Joffre Archer. Which just goes to show you that, that having the sort of ability that he has is utterly priceless, because you don't even have to play in order for people to realise how valuable you are. So he'll be down at the local NatWest cashing in another check whilst his back heals.
At least there's optimism that he might be back fully fit sooner than we might have previously thought.
I completely agree that it's not a surprise that they've kept Crawley and Axe Lees, but it is worth just dwelling on just how fortunate Crawley is, I think, considering that 12 months ago we were essentially in this exact same position where Crawley was kind of clinging on. There was actually, he wasn't even in the side, yet he was given the full deal over Hamid, who was just given an increment contract at the time. In some ways, that was vindicated because, you know, he made the 70 odd in the Ashes and then the century in West Indies. And equally, 12 months later, we are here in the same place again, where Crawley has sort of struggled through another summer where there's been sort of the odd spark here and there, but you can't really say you couldn't say he had a good summer. And those struggles continued into county cricket as well, where the other Kent openers all put up good numbers. And we're saying now, look, we're going into a tour where the flat pitches should suit him. And it kind of feels like make or break, but also it kind of feels like it's not, like, you know, like whatever happens, England will back him, and because that's just what they do. And there's not much he can do to not even get the best possible deal that there is in the country, if you know what I mean.
It's like watching Doctor Who. It's like it can be as dangerous and terrifying, and the characters as close to death as anything, but you know they're going to survive. You know, they're going to come out the other side. I think, to be honest, like, it doesn't really matter whether or not Lee stayed. They clearly had made up their mind. You know, they wanted to move on, and I think most people felt that was reasonable. You know, it wasn't a vintage summer for any opener, and if you're going to, for all the reasons that they've picked Zach Crawley so far, i.e. that he's got huge potential and that he looks amazing when he gets going, that still remains the case. Whereas with Lee's, it was that his argument to be in the side was weight of runs and quality scorecard stuff. As soon as you lose that, you've not really got a lot to answer for. It's a bit like when, like, a Mourinho side starts losing. It's like, well, if it's rubbish to watch and the results aren't good, why would I do it? Why would I stick with this? Obviously, at times Lee's looks class, but as Butch alluded to, it's not really his natural game.
Butch, you've got a question in from Sam Barnett, who asks, what's now considered good for an England Test opener?
I don't know, being able to strap your pads on. No, I mean, that's harsh. But funny. I don't know. I mean, I don't think that the bar has actually moved that much. You know, what would I be happy with if I was opening the batting for England? I'd be happy with making, over the course of 7 test matches in the summer, you'd want to make at least 100, maybe 3 if you have an absolute belter, but two would be your sort of like your benchmark for that many innings. And you'd want to be averaging somewhere around 40. I mean, I don't think that has changed a great deal. I mean, there are extenuating circumstances. None of the openers that came over here made any runs, whether they were from overseas or the England ones. Although the argument would be that if you're at home, that those are your conditions. You know, you're supposed to prosper in them, whilst others are supposed to find them difficult. I don't think that has changed particularly. I think if you're asking, see, there are two different ways of asking the question. One is from a team's point of view. The team might come at you with this is your role, this is what we need you to do. If you do this, and then anything above that is a real bonus, you know, and so you go and fulfill that, and the team is happy with you for fulfilling that role. Then you've got your own expectations of yourself and the sort of numbers that you would like to put on the board for your own personal pride, and in doing so, that helps the team. And those two things are often a little way apart.
I guess, but you could also read the question in that England have gone through so many openers. You kind of think there isn't anyone out there who's going to average 40. So what?
No,
would you
no,
accept?
I don't think so. But I think there were one or two who probably averaged mid 30s.
Who?
A couple that did it and were left out for doing so,
and have been released off the contract list in Rory Burns. I know it's more 30 than mid 30s, but I think it's been proven that the best in county cricket come into Test cricket, and for whatever reason, what all of the structural things that we've all spent years talking about, they come in and they can't turn a 55 champo average into a 40 test average or a 35 test average. And so to an extent, we're having the same conversations again. It's not really about selection. it's about structure. And that's why, you know, that's why we've been having the big conversations. It's no use sitting around being like, well, do you think Adam Lyne's going to do a better job than such and such? There might be a silver bullet. It might be an Ali Yor comes through and manages to kind of transcend the system. You know, and that's what you're always hoping for in any system.
But I don't know if I agree with that, though, because if that was the case, then, you know, England wouldn't have won 6 out of 7 test matches. They wouldn't have gone from being a hopeless test match side at home and away to winning 6 out of 7 test matches. I still think that there are...
But the guys who won those test matches were guys that were produced 15 years ago, 10, 15 years ago in terms of the...
Right, and guys who hardly play any county cricket at all anyhow. No, I know that. And that was entirely the point of England's fortunes went a long way up as soon as players were removed from the system. However, all of the players that were playing were produced by that system. Now, at the moment, it's got its issues.
Ollie Pope, I guess you could say he's an example that transcends the system, but he's a recent player that's come out of it. And Ben Foulkes as well, he is very much just a product of county cricket recently, played a lot of it and done well. One thing I feel about English openers and opening in this country is that because it is so hard, even if you were to say from a team point of view and that sort of thing, that maybe averaging actually, if you're facing a lot of balls, like high 20s, low 30s is a good thing. You can't do that for a sustained period of time and kind of not lose form because you will expect more of yourself. And if you are just getting out for a low score that's kind of out of your control, like once every 2 innings, basically, you won't be able to stop yourself asking questions of yourself and your technique and trying to find a solution to be more consistent. And that will then mean that you kind of have a shelf life just because the job is so tough. It kind of breaks you, no matter, not quite no matter how good you are, but even if you are a player that in another era, say, might have averaged 38 and therefore been able to feel like you're doing okay, because you don't feel like you're doing okay, at some point you will actually not be doing okay because of how much you'll be struggling with that mentally, if that makes sense.
The Burns-Sibley thing, I think it's quite interesting. There was an interview with Burns this week in The Telegraph where he pointed out that 16 of his 32 test matches were played in bio bubbles. Those are two guys who did the job very well for a year, and it was a crazy final 6 months of their test careers as it currently is, but they did do the job well. I think that has been forgotten a little bit. Anyway, moving on, England beat Australia in a very high-scoring series opener at Perth. Ben Stokes made his first T20I appearance in 18 months. His old mate Alex Hales hit 80-odd at the top of the order. Mark Wood bowled very well. He also bowled very quickly. He bowled several deliveries above 95 miles per hour. Sam Curran bowled well at the end. There was one moment that caused a bit of controversy online. I think it was one of the clearest examples of field obstruction I've ever seen. Matthew Wade kind of blocking. There's a handoff, rugby handoff to Mark Wood as he tried to catch a ball. And Jos Buttler then didn't appeal, which is very polite of him. Ben, was Jos Buttler being too English not appealing against Matthew Wade? Ask Cam.
In some way, you could say it's backfired because he wanted to, you know, avoid the headlines and not ruffle any feathers. And now we have people comparing him to match fixers and saying he should be thrown in jail. And I wish that was an exaggeration. I probably think he should have appealed. The one defence I would have accepted is if he came out and said, look, this is a proper warm-up and we wanted to test ourselves against a really good finisher in a pressured situation and see if we could get him out, you know, without having to not to resort to that, because Wood presumably would have caught the ball.
That's a lot of clear thinking in a very, very short space of time.
Yeah. I would have respected that defence a little bit more than just like...
We're not ready for a while.
Couldn't quite stand the hassle.
That's more of a Morgan response than a Buttler response, isn't it? A kind of instantaneous politician. I mean, I guess the one thing that did strike me, and it was that like, there's a lot going on in a very short amount of time. You could have just gone like, oh, I didn't see it. Just go full Wenger and just be like, ah, oh, you know, I was looking up at the ball, and then all of a sudden, oh, and you can get out of it without having to make a statement about the fact that you're in Australia for a while. And it all felt a little bit like, it felt a little bit like when you've been caught out by the teacher and you're like, you're trying to kind of quickly come up, oh no, it was there was a dog that ran in and barged over Matt Wade. Like,
the big boys did it. The big boys from another school.
Yeah, Mark would make my homework, kind of like, just if there was the opportunity to kind of pause time, write a statement, probably wouldn't come up with the one that he ended up with. But it was all very silly. Like, I think we need to maybe like write down all the rules that are involved in playing cricket. and put them in some kind of book and then just play the game according to them.
I think people forgot the law that says you can only be given out if you actually appeal, and the umpires can't give it out without the appeal.
I mean, that's be all and end of it. How many batters do you see fucking out LBW when nobody appeals? None. Because you have to appeal.
Yeah.
He didn't appeal. The incident is done. I mean, Mark Wood should have appealed, really. It was him that was being obstructed. All he had to do was turn around to the umpire and say, hang on, how's that? And the umpire would have given him out. And it would have been the least controversial obstructing the field decision ever given. Mm. Because there's not a single person who watched that thought, oh, that was okay.
It was brilliant, though, wasn't it? It was a proper look around. There he is.
I mean, so that's really the end of it. It really does not matter anymore. They didn't appeal, therefore the umpire couldn't give it out. Wade got away with one. England won the game.
It was like a rugby player in a tackle, kind of like gesturing to the ref, like, I'm trying to roll away. I'm trying to roll. When you're like literally like digging your heels in, like refusing to go.
I thought it was more like American football. He was literally trying. He was blocking for another runner.
It is a good point though that actually Mark Wood has, you know, escaped any sort of people questioning him, but people like Butler being the target of this sort of. He's almost become the face of English spirit of cricket kind of discourse, you know, with his interactions with Ashwin.
But, you know, do you actually think that there was anything to do? There was nothing to do with the spirit of cricket for why they didn't appeal there. Nothing. People are throwing this in there because people are doing that to try and justify another action, you know, conning people into leaving their crease and then running them out.
We're not talking about that. Please, no.
So the reason that even so anybody mentioned the spirit of cricket has come up was because of that. This was nothing to do with the spirit of cricket. This was like they just didn't appeal. It was like a ball goes past the outside edge. You find out later by Snicko that somebody nicked it. Nobody appealed. Not out.
Possibly. But if Butler's right in saying that he wants to avoid some sort of ruckus, the ruckus he wants to avoid is having any sort of that sort of accusation being pointed at him in England, right?
But that's just...
I agree. There's no spirit of cricket.
I don't buy that at all, simply because there's not a single person, no matter which country you come from, whether you're pink with purple spots on, would have looked at that and said, oh, that was a bit of a cheeky appeal by England. It was the most obvious case of obstructing the field that has ever occurred.
That's true. But I guess I guess you could say that because Butler didn't see it, he didn't know how obvious it was. And if it was a slightly more marginal case, you have had cases in the past where there's been marginal obstruction of the field cases and there have been spirit of cricket questions asked. Like when Ben Stokes was out obstructing the field against Australia and there was sort of a bit of debate over, was he trying to protect himself?
That was the second most obvious case of obstructing the field I've ever seen.
Even then you had Atherton suggesting that Steve Smith could withdraw the appeal. You had... you had Ian Botham saying, should the captain be appealing this?
They were wrong.
Yeah, sure. But the point is that I think that probably is why Butler has chosen not to. And if you thought about it and see people like, okay, that's fine, I can appeal that. But I do think there is it's at least spirit of cricket adjacent to the reasons why he chose not to appeal.
Every time I come on this podcast, every single time, Yaz is like, we're going to talk about T20, and then it normally means we talk about the county championship for an hour, and then I get 5 minutes on T20 at the end. This time, we're actually talking about a T20 game, and we're still not talking about T20. It's an absolute belting game.
Somebody asked Woody why he didn't just turn around and appeal, because there it is in a nutshell. The bloke who was obstructed turns to the umpire and says, sorry, mate, how's that? And this is done. Over.
As is this conversation. Ben, I'm going to ask you three questions in one. One from Rufus, who asked, what is Stokes' best position / role in the side is for the best place for him? But then also, Liam Livingston and Chris Jordan, who are in the World Cup squad, haven't played recently. That 11 that played Australia have all done pretty well recently. How do you fit those two guys in, if you do fit them at all, and where does Stokes stay at four?
I'll take the Stokes one first. I think Stokes, as a T20 player, is curious because we never get to see him play T20 cricket. And when he does, it's at the absolute highest level, basically. You know, he rarely gets to just, you know, find his feet, you know, in a quiet environment. It's normally in the IPL. But when he's had success in the IPL, it's been opening the batting. And I think that if Stokes is going to play T20 cricket and you want to get the best out of him, that's obviously where he plays. Now, that's true for a lot of players. Everyone wants to open the batting. All the fields are about a foot away. But like Stokes' conventional stroke play, obviously we've seen him get a bit funky occasionally, but basically he just plays proper cricket shots hard through the infield. And when he gets set, he can explode. So yeah, you want him owning the batting. The problem is that because he's got that kind of, I think England see him as that kind of selfless team man, they can kind of mould him into whatever they want to be. And also they back his just kind of kind of abstract ability, just the fact that he's a fantastic cricketer, they're like, well, he'll make it work. And the fact that there's no Bairstow means that there's now a vacant spot at number four. Oh, well, give it to Stokesy. He'll make it work. Personally, I'm not convinced, but I also have enough kind of faith in Stokesy's kind of, you know, kind of superhuman effort to try and at least make it work on a couple of occasions. I think in terms of getting everyone into the side, it's not too difficult. And I've just kind of jotted down that top seven once everyone comes back. I think he's probably going to go Butler, Hales, Milan, Stokes, Brook, Livingston, Moeen. And that's fine. Like, it's better than fine. It's fantastic. It's one of the best batting lineups in the tournament. I think what's probably helped England in a way is by not having Jason Roy lose form a week before the tournament, but having him lose form 6 months before the tournament and having Bairstow get injured, never a good thing, but it does mean that really there's not actually a kind of logjam of places here. You're basically looking at Phil Salt coming in ahead of Alex Hales. That's basically the only real thing, which when you come into selection debates is like, it should James Ward-Prowse be in the 20 rather than the first team. It's not hyper important to how the overall team go.
That changes how Sam Curran's used, though. He's currently at seven.
Exactly. And I think that Sam Curran's improvement with the ball, or apparent improvement with the ball, is massive, because it means that England have the option, should they want to have that kind of mega batting deep, terrifying thing of having Curran at eight and then potentially Wokes or Jordan at nine, which is outrageous, really. It opens up those opportunities. Of course, I think what they'll actually go with is they'll probably pick Topley because they need that power play threat, and I think they see him as their key power play bowler, rightly, I think. And I think they'll go with Chris Jordan because he's obviously played so much, and they see him as such a valuable all-round player in terms of his fielding as well, alongside Wood and Rashid, obviously. As much as they like Chris Wokes, I think if you think of how Wokes went last year in the UAE, what he was fantastic at was bowling good line and length on skiddy pitches where the ball just kicked on and hit the bottom half of the stumps. Now in Australia, it's going to sit up and he's a bit more vulnerable and he doesn't really move the white ball. Whereas Topley, I think, is almost the kind of similarly horses for courses pick off with his height and his bounce and he's quicker than you think. He's probably the guy to get you those new ball wickets, which is why maybe you need to think a little bit more about where that tail's coming from. It's all a little bit fiddly, but I think the top seven itself, with the exception of Moeen, and I know Butch has got thoughts on that, but I think basically it settles.
I don't think that you can pick all seven of the batters. I think one of them's going to have to miss out.
Curran?
Yeah, I think Curran's going to be at seven, because otherwise it leaves you a bowler short.
And Butler has been more inclined to play the bowler-heavy side than
he has
Morgan
been after Rajasthan. Yeah. After his experience of picking nine bowlers and one batter himself.
I think it leaves him a bowler short, because they're not entirely sure about what Stokes' role with the ball might be, and he's like a safety valve. Livingston's a safety valve. I think Stokes and Moeen are the two vulnerable guys there. If Livingston's fit and they're happy to put him back in the side, because he's absolutely 3-1 with off spin, leg spin, he kind of takes out the whole left hand, right hand thing for you. He just gives you something utterly priceless.
It's quite easy to get into the game.
Yeah, absolutely, utterly priceless, as opposed to Mo, who sometimes, depending on who the opposition is or the conditions, might not bowl at all. Could find himself coming in as low as six or seven. Could, I'm not saying will. So I think both Mo and Stokes are the two guys who potentially might end up sitting out for one reason or another. And that seems unthinkable given how. But that's the strength of England's batting at the moment.
It's quite.
I mean,
it's,
I suppose the other guy is Milan, isn't it?
Well, I was going to say
about he's had a, and you got more on this, but he's had a very quiet period of time. But then I think him coming in at first drop, in varying different circumstances, he's actually better at it because he's done it for longer than some of the others than somebody like Ben Stokes might be. But that's
Well, so I found it interesting that England did push Milan down the order in that first 20. I know that they'd done it before against, was it Sri Lanka in the T20 World Cup, and they were chasing a very small total. And it was also interesting they pushed him down the order in favour of pushing Stokes number three. And actually, in some ways, Stokes and Milan are quite similar profile players. And actually, Milan has gone some way to sort of shedding that reputation of being this slow starter that needs to kick on, whereas Stoke kind of is, or at least he hasn't proven that he's not that player.
And they're quite similar players. Yeah.
And that kind of showed that he got that 9 off 9, and that did stall England's momentum a little bit.
But don't underestimate the fact that it all could also have been he hasn't picked up a bat since here. So that they saw an opportunity that wasn't going to hurt them too much given the start they'd had to push him up there. Milan's last knock was a brilliant 80, wasn't it, in fact. So it could have been that. I hesitate to read too much into juggling batting orders at this point in time, given that they're trying to reintegrate players back into the team.
Yeah, that's true. I guess also the thing with Milan is there's almost like an inversion almost of how you have to view him now compared to like what, 24 months ago? Like at that point, he had these incredible international numbers that weren't sort of reflecting his numbers domestically, and he was kind of overperforming. He also had this thing going as sort of like a slow start, which people felt could damage England. Whereas now he actually is starting pretty quickly. He's up there. No, he's not like the very, very quickest in the world, but actually he's a top three batter for this year. I think he's up there. And he's had a very good year domestically, you know, was a key in that, in the Trent Rocket side that won the 100. And yeah, he's had a really poor time for it, or not really poor, but he's not been the Milan that we've come to know for England in the past. What, since the start of last year, he's averaging less than 30, striking at under 130. And that comprised about 2/3 of his overall career. And I guess we know that he's going to be suited to these conditions. And we do know what he can do if he does get a bit of form and a bit of momentum behind him. So I do think they will back him, but I think that there's questions to be asked again. Even though I would pick him in my team, he's also always feels like he's quite close to the door. It wouldn't take that much for England to be like, do we pick Curran or Milan? Let's go Curran, kind of thing.
Well, I think there's an argument that if you're, I don't think there is an argument. I think it's pretty straightforward that if you're constructing a side from scratch, you probably wouldn't have two players like Milan and Stokes at 3 and 4, because they're a little bit too similar in terms of their pacing. Obviously, great quality, but they're a little bit easy to plan for, off spin through the middle and all this kind of stuff. But the way that England have found themselves, you know, their World Cup winning opener has fallen off a cliff, so they've had to adapt there by bringing in a player who they previously ostracised completely. So they've made like a big change there. They've brought in a guy, Harry Brook, who had barely played a game of international cricket, or barely played a game of cricket in the last, before 12 months ago, and he's just shot to the top of everyone's, you know, next big thing lists. So they are trying to be innovative, and I think as a result, you don't want to make too many big changes at the last minute. And I think politically, dropping Mo or Stokes would be massive. Mo's just captained them for 7 games.
Yeah, I know.
One of the most politically important tours of the last 20 years.
I'm looking at an 11 that I've just sketched out at the minute. I'm looking at Mo, I'm looking at Ben, and I'm looking at Milan. There's three left-handers, right? So one of those three left-handers is probably going to miss out in order that England then can cover themselves in enough areas to get the right sort of bowling attack in. And that is with me picking Livingston and Brook at 4 and 5, or 5 and 4, whichever way round you want to put them. So it'd either be Mo or Stokes at 6, Milan at 3, or no Milan at 3, and both Mo and Stokesy play. You know, that's how I'm looking at it. Otherwise, you end up lining up three left-handers in a row in the middle as well, which is another thing you want to avoid, as I'm sure Mr. Jones will tell us. But, you know, it's kind of, you know, there are three left-handed players in there. Moeen perhaps is the most compelling in terms of just his ball striking. He's just so sublime. But I think both he and Ben right now, for me, are the ones that kind of are under some sort of threat of being switched out for one another. That's how I see them right now.
The one last point, which I think is it's very niche, I think, but it's important to think that we're not talking about planning an abstract side. This is to play in a World Cup in a few weeks' time, and we know who they're going to be playing by and large. And actually, if you look in England's group, you've got New Zealand, Australia, and Afghanistan. Now, Australia, their left to right spinner, get my dyspraxia right, is Maxwell. So, are you back in Milan, Stokes, Moeen to take down Maxwell? Probably just about, in Australian conditions. Afghanistan, you've got Mujib and Nabi. Mujib's obviously excellent, but not a big turner of the ball. So, it's not really about the left-handedness. And Nabi, you'd back yourself to take down in Australia. And then it comes to New Zealand, and then you're looking at guys like Glenn Phillips and Kane Williamson as your left-to-right spinners. So there's no gun off-spinner that you're kind of terrified of. Now, that could change, because you could end up with Sri Lanka, and then you've got Dikshana, or you could end up with any of the kind of associate players who come through. So there are still concerns, but of the big threats in the spin department for the teams we know they're going to be playing, there's no offies. So you kind of have to, you know, take it all with a pinch of salt, the whole right and left hand thing.
But is it possible that we'll know their first choice team for 6 of the opposition sides of the World Cup, but just because of how they line up themselves and what their bowling stats look like, and we'll vary that for others? Like, if there is a team that has a good left to right spinner, they'll be like, actually, no, we're going to separate the left handers. I think
it's more separate the left handers rather than necessarily pick anyone, because realistically, Phil Salt's a fantastic player, but he's a guy that needs to bat 1 or 7. Really, like, he's not a guy that you want to slot in at 4 to separate Milan and Stokes. Yeah. So really, you're basically saying what would happen is you might push Livingston up or push Brook up, and it might look a bit funny, and you might end up with some snarky stories about the idea of, oh, why have England been, they've demoted Ben Stokes to number 6, and it's actually because they're trying to manage the opposition. But you'd rather do that, I think, than get too funky with selection. The players that they've got are the players they want. It'll just be tweaking formations, I think.
There is a new Wisden Cricket Monthly magazine coming out this week. There's an interview with Ollie Pope that we'll play some of later in the show. There's a really interesting feature that hears from people who actually attended 100 games this season that we mentioned a couple of times on the pod already, and they kind of tell us how they viewed the experience of watching 100 games live. And then there's a presentation of CricVizz's list of the best 20 T20 players in the world with a profile on each of them. The top five are Shaheen Afridi at 5, Bumrah 4, Narayan 3, Butler 2, Rashid Khan number 1. There's no Virat Kohli, Babar Azam, KL Rahul or Rohit Sharma in the top 20. So at Ben Jones Cricket to direct your fury. Ben, how was the list compiled? When was it compiled? Tell us how you did it.
So it was very, very scientific in some ways. And we used kind of CricVizz models, Match Impact, which is our measure of basically white ball performance across the board. We used that to give us a bit of a guide and kind of weighted that accordingly. So, you know, if you've been good for 3 years, that was better than being good for 1 year, all that kind of stuff, to get a bit of a short list. And then as the CricVizz analyst team, you know, there's about, you know, 7 or 8 of us scattered across the world. We all kind of took our own rankings to try and, again, get the shortlist in some kind of order. And then we kind of put the projection numbers back on top of it. And then at the last, wherever we thought it wasn't quite right, went in and had a bit of a fudge and tweaked it around. Because I think, as we mentioned in the piece, we wanted the list to not just be like a objective thing of these are the X number of players who've performed at this level, da, da, da. We wanted it to an extent, tell a little bit of the story of what's happened in T20 cricket. And so that's nudged, for although Rashid Khan probably would have come top anyway. He probably would have been challenged by Joss and Narayan. But the story of Rashid this year winning the PSL and winning the IPL as like a pivotal part of both sides in different ways, we wanted to try and reflect that as and when we could, if it was ever a kind of dead heat. So yeah, a mixture of science and art, as all things should be.
So I've got a couple of questions around the list. So Bumrah is pretty much the only one on that list who is known particularly for their skill at the death. Obviously, it's a horrible job, but are most death bowlers a bit of a much of a muchness, and there's not actually that much difference between them? If it is so difficult for pretty much everyone other than a tiny elite group, does it almost matter that much who bowls at death in T20 cricket if they're all just being clobbered?
I think the notable thing is that Bumrah is not just the best death bowler, he's just the best seamer, like full stop. He is, so it doesn't matter what phase it is. And that kind of accords with something we're kind of looking into at CricVizz, and it plays into a preconception I've had for a while, which is in short, pithy, Twitter-ready form, there are no good death bowlers. If you are good at the death, it's because you're good, not because you're particularly good in that phase. The skills are the same elsewhere. And so Bumrah being the guy there who stands out as a death bowler, alongside Archer, we should say, because although we can talk about his fitness, etc., he's still one of the best seamers in the world when he's around. The skills needed are the skills to be a good T20 bowler, full stop. It's being able to be quick enough, being able to bump people, being able to execute Yorkers, being able to bowl to a field, bluff, bowl against a field, all those kind of things. And actually, there's not much evidence, as far as we can find, and I'm sure people will find it annoying me saying it. It's very geeky and nerdy, but actually, there's not much evidence that there's a specific skill in being able to be an effective death bowler. And it all comes back to the old thing of nailing New Yorkers. We'd all love to be able to nail every Yorker, but Jasprit Bumrah nails 1 in 2, and he's essentially off the chart in terms of how good he is at executing those balls. Most people are 1 in 3, 1 in 4, and those balls that don't land are horrifyingly expensive, 12 runs per over, 13 runs per over. So actually, the most recognisable death skill in the world, the perfectly landed Yorker, is kind of under question. And I know that that's what people want me to say. It's a kind of slightly annoying numbers guy. I'm happy to hear counters, but I think that's probably why we haven't included many specific role-based death bowlers, guys who just do that role.
The bowlers will be very happy to hear you say that, simply because it's something that they've always known, is that you get it right, it's brilliant. You get it wrong, it's 6. You know, and so your margins for either good or bad,
particularly with new bats, lower middles, all that.
Absolutely, yeah. So I mean, so it's understandable that they would shy away from that unless perhaps they got the ball reversed in a little bit, which gives you that bit more margin, which we very rarely see anymore. And I'm guessing the other reason that because death bowling is situational. you could have gone for 35-40 in your previous three overs, but then you bowl the last over and you win the team the match. You win the team. You win the team the match defending 20. You go for 19. You've won the game, right? So statistically, it's very difficult to kind of to come up with a model that kind of shows, you know. So Chris Jordan, for example, I always think of him in this because people remember Chris Jordan's bad overs, and he has a lot of them because he bowls in a lot of situations whereby that's likely to happen. But maybe I'm not entirely sure what the percentage is, but I'm guessing that sort of two out of three times, given a situation where he's defending a game in the last over, no matter what he's bowled before, he wins it, right? Which you'll be able to find out. It probably isn't as high as that. It's probably 1.5 times out of three or something, or 1.2 times out of three. But the thing with bowling at the end is you are literally playing that tiny, tiny piece of the match, and the rest and anything else that's happened before makes no difference. You could bowl three of the worst balls in the final, the 20th over of the game or the 19th over of the game, but then the last three balls are an absolute genius, and you win them, and you win the game by virtue of bowling three balls or even two balls. You know,
it's so interesting because I completely understand that, and that's definitely how people read the game, and I think it's how fans see the game, because ultimately you're like, you look at the score, you look at the over, you know, with 10 to win off the last over. And suddenly you're like, right, everything else is irrelevant. What happens now is the game. Mm. And that's what you remember when it goes wrong, and it's what you remember when it goes bad. And that's why death bowling is so glamorous and why death batting is so glamorous. But I think the whole idea of you're playing a particular segment of the game and that alone is kind of how I see the game generally, or how I see the format generally. In terms of numbers and kind of the analysis side of things, a wicket in the first over is worth, I think, 10 runs in a T20 game. If you take a wicket in the first over, you're 10 runs ahead. And so whilst it may have happened 4 hours ago in an IPL game and everyone's moved on, but actually Josh Hazlewood, who's on the list as one of the best seamers in the world, him taking 2 for spit in the power play, and then even if he comes back and goes at 10s, 12s at the end, his good work has been done 4 hours ago. You forget about it. And also, just as a little counter, it's something we're looking into. I don't want to kind of nail my colours to the mast too strongly, but our analysis does suggest that there are specific skills associated with being a power play bowler that transcend whether you're good or bad or not. And we all recognise this instinctively in terms of, oh, he can swing the white ball. People say that even if, you know, you go at 10s all through the innings, you might instinctively go, oh, well, this guy does swing it. And so there's a tangible skill there. There isn't quite the same, according to our analysis at least, in the death department.
And I think Jordan's an interesting example on that as well, because he had that quite bad year where he bowled predominantly at the death for England. But actually, he had a good period of time where he bowled earlier on in the innings as well. And you're actually like, you know what? He's a good bowler in other phases of the innings that are not his speciality. And you're almost like, you're doing yourself a disservice by pigeonholing yourself as a death bowler, because it's going to go madly quite a lot of the time.
And yeah, it's basically a gambler's mentality.
Hazlewood's kind of the opposite as well. Like, you think of Hazlewood as like, if you could imagine someone in your head who would be a bad death bowler almost, even if they're good at other times, it would be him, because it's so just like, you know, just short of a length, hit the same spot again and again. And that can be very good with the new ball, where you can break through and be good when people aren't trying to hit you, because they'll just kind of knock it around and there's not the obvious bad balls. And at the death, they're trying to line you up. You'd think you'd go for plenty. And he doesn't. He's pretty good there as well, right? So it's like he's an example of a guy who is just, I mean, he's excellent in some phases, and he's good at the death because he's a good bowler.
I mean, Shaheen is the daddy, isn't he? He's kind of, talk about somebody who's impactful at both ends of the game, you know. He'll gain you 20 runs by taking 2 wickets in his first spell, and he'll invariably pick you up 2 wickets at the end. I mean, he's just kind of, he's the daddy, isn't he?
Well, I love the contrast and the kind of inherent rivalry. Geez. Well, I was going to say between Shaheen and Bumrah, and Shaheen is this consummate attacking bowler, as the guy who is just constantly looking for wickets at the top, and then will go defensive at the end because ultimately that's what the currency is, but he's still looking for wickets with Yorkers. Whereas with Bumrah, his strike rate in the power play is actually quite low. His strike rate in the power play is quite high, surprisingly high. His bowling average isn't great. And that's partly because people are trying to play him out because he's Jasprit Bumrah, but also because he's not quite looking for wickets in the same way. He's bowling more of that kind of back of a length, you know, hit you in the chest kind of stuff. And it's just quite interesting that these guys are both basically, as far as I'm concerned, archers just a drop below. Those are the two kind of Messi, Ronaldo, T20 seamers. And they both perform in quite different ways. And it's quite nice that you still end up with this variety of roles, even though the game sometimes gets accused of being a little bit simplistic and a bit one note. You've got guys who are going about it very, very differently and both having huge success.
Ben, you had an observation of about the spinners who made the list.
Yeah, it's not hugely revelatory, but all the spinners in the list all bat. And you also see this in the IPL as well in terms of spinners that get picked up. Someone like Adam Zampa, for example, should have been player of the tournament at the last T20 World Cup. He's got brilliant recent numbers, brilliant overall numbers, especially I think someone's remarking that since his googly has sort of come on, he's almost like a transformed bowler in terms of being able to contain and take wickets. He doesn't find a place, I don't know how close he was, but I think that's sort of how good can you be as a spinner almost without batting, is there that much of muchness and you need that extra string to your bow in a way?
Yeah, it's interesting because it's something I feel a little bit uncomfortable with, because it's all a bit team construction, market dynamics kind of stuff. I mean, the old thing about why Zampa and Adil Rashid never got IPL gigs was because there were 10 gun Indian spinners. Why would you go overseas and get that when there weren't many good seamers who were domestic? So you'd spend your overseas slot there. But I think what we're seeing now as well is that there was a period of time where pace bowling all-rounders, guys like Ben Cutting and that kind of thing, were valued really highly. And those bowlers started to just get whacked. Part-time seam or kind of suboptimal seam, those kind of 7 out of 10 bits and pieces players, just started to get absolutely destroyed by batters. And so suddenly there was a move towards focusing recruitment on quality seamers, guys you didn't care whether they batted or not. Bumrah being kind of the perfect example in some respects. They just go in, bowl their overs, they don't worry about anything else. They might even be terrible fielders, whatever. You just get those guys in. As a result, you need to get your spin overs from someone who also offers you a bit with the bat. And so I think whilst Wanindu Hasaranga might not be a much better bowler than Yuzvendra Chahal, I think they're probably about the same thing. I think Hasaranga's slightly better. The overall value that you get from building a side around someone like Hasaranga, or Narine, or Rashid Khan,
or Shadab Khan as well.
Or Shadab Khan, again, another great example. These guys allow you to pick genuine seamers. And we've seen basically the drop-off between first frontline spinners and part-time spinners is less than the drop-off between top-level seamers and part-time seamers. Part-time seam is bad. It's really bad. And so you need your spinners to be able to offer you a little bit with the bat. And it's why someone like Yuzi Chahal gets a bit of a bad rap and probably doesn't get quite appreciated in the same way, because he doesn't quite fit into a side in a way that's easy to balance and easy to construct around the world. Yeah, it's all, as with all of this stuff, it'll be cyclical, and in 4 years' time, it'll be different. And people will just be going out getting the best spinners, and there'll be a glut of seam bowling all-rounders.
And one other observation from me, you said it earlier on the show that everyone wants to open the batting in T20 cricket. There are only three openers on the list: Butler at number two, Warner, who's in the top 10, and Rizwan just about sneaks in. And me and Ben were talking about it yesterday. We were thinking of, who are the other openers who are really good at T20 cricket? And we actually could think of a lot of guys who are very good. There was no one who I thought was unlucky to not make that list of openers.
Yeah.
What makes that job so difficult to be like, what is it that Butler and Warner do? Why is that category so small when so many people want to do it, if that makes sense?
The three that came closest for us were Kara Rahul, who I guess that's probably partly a form thing. There would have been a time when Kara Rahul had been right in this list, I guess.
Yeah, no question.
Rohit Sharma, I guess also with his new approach recently, if this kind of carries on, you might look at a guy who can go quickly and then go big as well. He possibly might at some point, I guess. But then I think there's kind of a big next bracket where Quinton de Kock is probably at the head, and I think he is that very, very good, but not quite great level, I guess.
Or Hales, that kind of level, yeah. I think probably the kind of slightly boring answer is that I think it's quite hard, and you rarely see guys who are really poor at opening. There is a lot of players on a similar level, because ultimately, statistically, you're going to score runs because all the fielders are in the ring. And so it's quite hard to go through a really, really poor run as a T20 opener. I mean, Jason Roy managed it, Kane Williamson managed it early this year, but it is quite rare. Generally, you might be a bit slow starting, or you know, you might get a couple of high scores and then fall away. But generally, people average out a bit more than middle overs players and lower order players. So guys like Tim David coming in at 4-5, arriving to the crease in the 14th over with the run rate at 10s, they're probably going to need to go. So you're going to have that higher fluctuation. You're going to have games where you're basically just going to go out and whack it up in the air first ball, because that's what the situation deserves. A little bit like we were talking about with the death bowlers, is that you're playing the situation far more as a lower order player than you are as a top order player. And so consistency for a lower order player like David or Suryakumar Yadav, who, for what it's worth, I'd have had as
the best batter in the world if I'd have had my way, if I'd have pulled rank, but I didn't. The thing that marks them apart is that they manage to play the situations, but they do it consistently. They're able to eradicate those games where they come in and whack it up in the air. And so the amount of times that Surya Kumar comes in, hits the first ball for four, gets 20 off 10, and that's basically as bad as his innings ever gets. Whereas, you know, a lower calibre of player in that role goes dot, 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 30 off 10, dot, dot. And you see that greater fluctuation. It's guys that can kind of override that. And I guess that's the same with Warner and Butler, is that what they do more than anyone is just consistently get those high scores that without being slow, and in a way that sometimes Babar and Rizwan are accused of, quite rightly, of being.
Is there a question to be answered then around the relative strength of the rest of your batting lineup? Because everybody wants to open, right? And so therefore you need to be scoring quite heavily and in order to keep your place at the top of the order. You know, there's a lot of upward pressure from people who want your job. But is there also a case that in lineups that don't go all the way up to 11, as the Spinal Tap boys might have called it, you know, the guys at the top then without being selfish, but kind of protect themselves and their run scoring and their strike rates a little bit. You know, as we've seen with Pakistan and the accusation levelled at Babar and Rizwan, I suppose, because they're a little bit worried that if they don't score the runs, then nobody else is going to score them at a better rate than they're able to. And so your ability then to have a huge impact, a Butler-like impact, over the course of the innings becomes diminished because you're slightly protective of what comes after you.
I think there's a difference between saying that opening the batting is easier and saying that it's not important. It's still probably the most important batting spot in the side because you're the guy who has the opportunity to face 70 balls and dictate the game. So
it doesn't matter.
Yeah, exactly. So that, we never get away from that. And as much as you say there's only three on the list, it's 3 out of 20. That's actually a relatively decent number. And, you know, if you had more than that, it would be us just going, who averages 35 and scores at more than 7? So I think you have to respect that with Butler, Warner and Rizwan, you've actually got three nice demonstrations of the kinds of opener you have. You've got the anchor of Rizwan, who is one model of opener, who is genuinely just never going to come out and whack it from ball one. He's going to try and get 70 or 45, and that's perfect for the team that they need. Butler as a guy who can probably be a bit of, who can go up and down and, you know, be ultra aggressive when he needs to be. But for Rajasthan, when they had no one batting below 6, and even at 6, you had Riyan Parag, you were talking about a guy who needed to make runs every game. And then Warner offering sort of a bit of a mixture between the two, consistency. They're basically, I think opening allows you influence, but it is just easier statistically. It's just obvious. I mean, anyone who's got their head screwed on can notice that if you let someone open the bat in, suddenly their average goes up and the run rate goes up.
I only have one major gripe with the list with one player I think is too high, but I'm not going to say who it is. You're going to have to buy the magazine to work that out for yourself. Question for all you guys, really. If CricViz were coming up with this list in 2027, we need to predict a couple of people who are not in that top 20 now who you think would definitely be there then. So you can't say Rashid Khan because he's still in the list, for example.
Well, one guy who I think should be, but and arguably he should have been given a chance to show he should be in it now, would be Prithvi Shaw, I guess, who is this brilliantly attacking IPL opener. He's played a little bit for India. He's I think one of the scorers, power play scorers the IPL has had, and he's kind of like a new age player, but India for some reason just don't really trust him. They've picked the second string side to play South Africa in ODIs at the moment, and his record across all formats is brilliant, and they just don't really seem to pick him. I mean, the same goes in tests. He was India's leading run scorer in the series against New Zealand that they lost 2-0. Admittedly, that's quite a low bar. Then he has one test against Australia in which everyone fails, they get bottled up for 36, and he's dropped and has kind of never been seen again. There's something weird going on there, but just in terms of what he's done in the IPL, he's been, if you were to just rank IPL openers, he would be right up there. And that suggests that if he were to get a go across the world, he might be. And if he gets that chance, we'll see what happens, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Anyone else?
Harry Brook. Mm-hmm. Tristan Stubbs.
Stubbs was going to be my one. Stubbs or Brevis. I guess the other one you would say was not quite pushing statistically yet would be Nasim Shah, as a guy, I think, in terms of raw materials, to coin the phrase. You know, he can be that Shaheen style bowler of going full at the start and then varying it, and he's got the pace to do it. And we know that if there's one thing Pakistan will definitely do is identify talent and give him the chance he deserves to play over the next few years. Also, one other name, which is a slightly more boring one, is Josh Phillippe. Sounds like a very very niche one, but I think he's a guy who's had like a weird couple of years, but who, as I've been identified probably in this version of this podcast 3 years ago, is the next big thing. But I think a guy who is as consistent as he is in the BBL will eventually find a way to almost go to that next level, not quite Warner, but a guy who can churn out averaging 40, striking at 135 in other leagues around the world. And at that point, he becomes, you know, one of the most valuable.
I'm picking Arshdeep Singh, who I think is going to have an amazing World Cup, especially with Bumrah not there. Next up, a chat with Ollie Pope. After a stellar summer, which featured a big promotion, a championship title and a starring role in England's Red Bull revolution, Ollie Pope sat down to have a chat with Joe. You can read the full interview in the latest Wisden Cricket Monthly, but you can hear a sneak preview of that chat now.
Yeah, going back to the start of this year, when obviously things weren't going so well, I mean, that Ashes tour must have been draining for you personally and the team as a whole. What kind of mental state were you in by the end of it, come kind of January, February, when you were starting to think about the new season?
Yeah, to be honest, I was pretty flat. I think I left that trip and it wasn't at all, there's no coming back from this. That never really crossed my mind, but I thought it might be a bit of a slower process, to be honest. I remember I had a good, well, Ruti sort of put his arm over me. I remember in Tasmania and was like, if you do one thing from this Ashes trip, is make sure you use this as the biggest learning curve and do what you need to do with it rather than sort of hide away. He said, we know what an amazing player you are. It's not the end of the road at all. It's use that in the right way rather than go and sort of sulk about it in a way. And I tried to just get back to life as normal pretty quickly after. But yeah, the end of it was a brutal trip, to be honest. It felt like everywhere you go, you sort of just got stick from every Aussie out there. And but I've taken some massive learnings from it, and I've learned what works well for me as a player and as a person as well to help me perform well.
And that advice coming from Joe, who, you know, had his own difficult Ashes trip, ended up getting dropped on a tour, and to see him come back and be as fantastic as he's been, does that give you an extra bit of confidence as well, that you can see that he's been through a similar career trajectory and come out the other side of it so brilliantly?
Yeah, definitely. He's always someone I talk to a lot about batting, but also about the career path. And I'm not comparing us at all in any ways. He's probably the best England has ever had, in my opinion, anyway. So I'm not trying to draw too many comparisons to that. But he got into the team early. He had some good success early. He got dropped fairly early as well. So I use that and that from a mindset point of view, and how he dealt with that is, and I try and sort of learn off that, learn what I can off that. So yeah, and he's great for me to, he sort of takes me under the wing a little bit, it feels like, and we talk a lot about those things. So yeah, he's been great for me to have.
You said you didn't by any means think it was the end of the road, but had doubts started to creep in that Test cricket might be something that was going to be tougher to crack than you had initially anticipated? Obviously it started off pretty well for you.
Yeah, I think I found it so frustrating for a while. I'm not saying I've cracked it at all, but I've become more consistent this summer, and I've got some big aspirations sort of going forward as well. And I want to be becoming more and more consistent at that format. And it was just something I found for a while quite frustrating, and I almost realised that I think I was almost putting myself under too much pressure in a way. I'd do anything to succeed and to have a career like these legends have had, and look back at the end of it and go, and you want to be someone that's got every bit of success that is in there out of yourself. And I couldn't work out why I wasn't sort of taking my performances for Surrey into that arena. And so I think I tried to almost become a little bit more relaxed around the Test match week and put a lot more hard work in prior to it, right? Not just the 2 days before, but so for example, before the West Indies trip, I hit more than I ever had, and I needed to be honest, because my game wasn't where it needed to be. And even now, I'm doing a lot more work outside of the actual training days rather than just cramming it in the day before and thinking that's gonna serve me well. So yeah, and then once I go into a Test match week this summer, I've just enjoyed it more than ever, and I think Baz has probably been a big factor in that, and Stokesy as well, and just putting the enjoyment back into it rather than thinking that if I miss out this week, then it'll be my last one for a while. So yeah, it's been the last sort of 12 months have been a really good learning curve for me as a whole. And I think you need to have those low moments and those dark days in a way to work out what does work well for you and what doesn't work for you.
a few people picked up on the fact that you maybe looked a little bit frenetic at the crease and the Ashes, maybe a bit like you're saying, trying maybe a bit too hard even. I wonder, do you think that was a fair comment, and how have you been able to address that, if so?
I think the frenetic one I've never really got, because when I score quick hundreds, then apparently that's my positive in a way. So it's not necessarily being frenetic. I think it's actually probably looks that way because I'm always looking to score. I'm always looking to get down the other end early in the innings because that's what works well for me. It's almost more just staying on my shot a bit longer. I think it's as simple as that. And I think the way I played line, for example, was probably more of a lack of a game plan, putting too much time into the seamers. And then he got me out twice early and I wasn't clear enough on how exactly I wanted to play him, I think. So it's not necessarily being frenetic and that kind of thing. It's more just having a lack of clarity about how I wanted to go about an innings and how I wanted to play a bowler like him. So then staying in my shot that little bit longer. And that comes from, as you get into an innings, that frenetic side sort of gradually disappears because you pick up the ball that little bit quicker and you're seeing a little bit better and you've got the feel for the game. So I always find that one an interesting one when people have said the frenetic thing, because that I'm frenetic when I score hundreds as well. So yeah, it's a positive, but I guess it can look at like a negative on the bad days.
Elsewhere in the international game, Australia beat West Indies 2-0 in Australia. A second string India beat South Africa 2-1 in some ODIs, which leaves South Africa in even more trouble with regards to 2023 World Cup qualification than they were before. Ben, that leaves the door open for Ireland. This is the bit that Butch has been waiting for. But also your moment of the week is from that series.
Should we cover the Super League stuff first? So I actually think there's been a bit too much doom and gloom in a way around South Africa's chances. Like, people have basically said when that Australia series cancelled, like, they just don't have a hope to qualify. And actually, they still have a hope even now. I mean, they'll play England at home. They'll have a chance in that series. They'll go into its favourites. But even if they get a win in that and then win their two games against the Netherlands, then they'll have a chance. And that would almost knock out Ireland. Sri Lanka, you'd probably say, just about favourites at the moment. They've got two series left against New Zealand away, Afghanistan at home. But equally, they could lose both of those and they could lose the New Zealand 1-3-0. And then Ireland have one series left against Bangladesh at home. They will have a chance of winning that. So it's kind of, it's all to play for. I won't go through the exact who needs how many wins to overtake who, because that could get quite long and boring. But my favourite, my moment from this series...
Sorry, just on the Ireland thing, if Ireland qualify, that means that one of Sri Lanka, West Indies, South Africa will not go to the World Cup at all.
Yes, yes.
Because three of them will be in the qualification tournament.
Worth pointing out, yeah. My moment of the week from that South Africa-India series was a ball that Kuldeep Yadav bowled to Aidan Markram in the first ODI, which there's a few things I liked about it. First, it spun miles, you saw that straight away, and then you watched the replay and realised that it spun even more than you thought. Like, you kind of thought that maybe it had spun and gone right through the gate and taken out sort of middle and off, or maybe that it had taken a bit of inside edge, actually hadn't turned that much. And then you saw it actually, it flicked off his pad and so turned actually a little bit sort of like the other way, so it turned so much. And then people were talking about the amazing setup beforehand, which I sort of buy to an extent, but I also think he just bowled five balls, none of which Aidan Markram could pick, and eventually one of them kind of got him out, and he just looked like he didn't have a clue. Kuldeep Yadav has had a toughish time of it since being sort of one of the most highly rated wrist spinners in the world. This was in the third ODI, which India cleaned up South Africa for 99 to win the series. He took his first forfeit in international cricket since early 2019, so it's been a little while out, and he's obviously not in that World Cup squad. This is a second string squad that's playing, but he looks like he's on his way back now.
Elsewhere, other T20 World Cup preparation. New Zealand are hosting a tri-series with Bangladesh and Pakistan. New Zealand and Pakistan have exchanged wins, while Bangladesh have lost both games they played so far. And Ben, the Women's Asia Cup has had a few newsworthy moments. Do you want to talk us through what's happened? The main event was Thailand beating Pakistan.
Yes. Well, I think we need just a little snippet of Asia Cup history, just because it builds up how big the tournament has been. So up until 2018, India hadn't just won every edition of the Women's Asia Cup. They had won every game they had played in the Women's Asia Cup. And then in the 2018 tournament, Bangladesh, and not Pakistan or Sri Lanka, who you traditionally think is the next rank, but Bangladesh beat India twice. So you think, okay, there's something going on here. Bangladesh won that tournament. And now you have a tournament where it feels like anyone can beat anyone. So Thailand beat Pakistan. Pakistan beat India. Bangladesh were the defending champions, haven't even made the semis. They had a washed out game, which kind of ended their chances. So you have India v Thailand, which will be, you know, presumably India will win that game, but a great opportunity for Thailand. And this is also following on from the Women's T20 World Cup qualifiers, which was similar, really, in terms of everyone being able to beat everyone. I think UAE shocked Zimbabwe in that. Bangladesh, Ireland, Zimbabwe, Thailand, Scotland all could have gone through. They pushed each other close or took wins off each other. I think USA were the only team to come out of that without a win. And then you had the Women's World Cup qualifier last year, which was cancelled very quickly as soon as it became a slight logistical challenge for the ICC to rearrange or postpone or anything. And in that also kind of looked like everyone was taking wins off each other. And yet you have a situation where the 2025 ODI World Cup will only have 8 teams. The next T20 World Cup will only have 10 teams. And even the 2026 World Cup will only increase to 12, really, which is minuscule when these results show that, you know, down to the
Thailand
were
13th ranked in the world. And,
that you can beat one of the best teams or something the best teams in the world. You can beat another of the best teams in the world. A 14 or even a 16 team World Cup could be possible and supported, and the ICC just don't really have the ambition to do that, I think.
Mm. This is very much the Ben bit of the show. We've got one other question that Ben's going to answer for us. Johnny asks, I'm a bit confused why Pakistan and India are launching women's T20 tournaments which aren't connected to the PSL or the IPL. Surely it would be simpler and more successful and probably cheaper to create women's teams for each franchise. What am I missing?
So I'm not absolutely certain on this, but my instinct is that it's because these franchises are privately owned, basically. You can't just say to Mumbai Indians or Peshawar Zalmi, you have to make a women's team now. And then if you call it a women's IPL that's actually not really an IPL because it's not the same team, you're kind of looking like, why are we not just doing something that is standalone? With the IPL, well, with, you know, the Women's T20 Challenge, which hasn't really been a women's IPL, that's also had fewer teams than an IPL as well. So I think that's the issue, is that if you'd started it from the beginning, or as you've seen in with the Big Bash League, where the Women's Big BBL was started a bit after the BBL, but the teams were centrally owned and run, then you can just say, okay, we're running these as sort of joint entities, but it's much more difficult to do that with a privately owned venture, I guess. I think I'd imagine that'd be the situation. One thing, by the way, we haven't mentioned, and I imagine it's Butcher's moment of the week, is from the West Indies Australia series. Did you see the Kyle Mayers shot? The shot that went around the world?
No, I didn't. What happened?
Did you not see this?
Oh, you are the only person who didn't see it.
How did I miss
this? You must have been flying at this point. Everyone in the world.
Hey, listen, leave my private life out of it.
it just instantly people saying this must be the greatest cricket shot ever played, basically. I don't know how you describe it.
It's a back foot cover drive to a ball which is sent almost a bouncer.
Goes 105 meters.
And it goes 105
second
meters
tier
over extra.
And his elbow is impossibly high, as is the bat. We'll watch it after, Butch. You'll really enjoy it.
And he holds the shot in a way that's befitting of the shot that he's playing. That makes sense. He knows how good it is.
If it was proportional, but you know, quality of shot to length of hold the pose, he'd still be holding it. Yeah. It's unbelievable.
And finally, the photographer David Griffin shared the minutes of a Derbyshire County Cricket Club committee meeting from 1973 the other day. It includes a paragraph that says, the club have been offered the services of a Mr. A. Roberts, brackets fast bowler, and a Mr. V. Richards, brackets batsman from the West Indies. These two young players have been training at the Govers School in London, but have decided that if any overseas player was to be engaged, he must be of the highest class, and these two could not be considered. Lawrence Rowe was signed up as the overseas for Derbyshire in 1974 and didn't reach three figures in any of his 17 county championship appearances. That kind of links to a question we got recently from Will Griffin, who, referencing Luke Wells's release from Sussex and subsequent success at Lancashire, asked, can the pod think of any poorer decisions by a county to release a player who subsequently got on to prove them wrong and have a successful career?
So I was thinking about Dick Rowe of Decca Records turning down the Beatles.
Who's he let go by? Joe's message in from Holiday to help us out on this one. So he said, Darren Stevens wasn't offered a new contract by Leicestershire before he went to Kent. Tim Murta was released by Surrey when he had a year left in his contract, although it was Alan Butcher who was being nice because he thought he needed more opportunities. And then Ben Compton.
I tried to persuade him to stay.
Well, there we go. And then, obviously, Ben Compton had a very good summer. He was let go by Notts. Ben, you don't have a county championship example, but you've got an IPL one.
quite appropriately. No, it was just before the last mega auction, politically, it was a bit of a mess, seemingly, at Sunrisers Hyderabad. But they did, at the time, have Rashid Khan, obviously, officially the best T20 player in the world, according to Kriviz, and David Warner, officially, the second best opener. And Warner is obviously historically been very associated with Sunrisers and has captained them and has been, you know, one of their, probably the most famous player. But had a falling out with the hierarchy, with the powers that be. Rashid Khan seemingly wanted to stay, but maybe wanted to get the captaincy, all those kind of wranglings behind the scenes. And he wasn't convinced to stay. And as a result, they both left at the end of that cycle. And then as a result, they kept Kane Williamson. Of the three of them, of Williamson, Warner and Rashid, Sunrisers threw their weight, 14 crores worth of it, behind Kane Williamson, who then went on to have, according to Kriviz, Match Impact, statistically the worst IPL season of all time. so they gave up the best ever spinner, arguably the best ever batter, for a guy who didn't really deliver a huge amount. Hopefully Kane comes back, but it sprung to mind when it was a, you know, worst decisions. I know, maybe yeah. Recency bias, but
wonderfully on brand. And very, very finally, my moment of the week is my discovery of Matthew Hayden's Instagram profile. At Haydos359 has 262,000 followers, and he just does really good recipe videos. So he loves his curry, and yeah, he's got a goat curry recipe that's got 6.5 million views, Thai green curry that's got 243,000 views, lots of different curries, crab recipe, barbecue thing he's done.
Checking the post, is it?
Genuinely loads. So if you're short on recipes this week, head to at Haydos359 on Instagram to get your fill. Anyway, that is all we have time for today. Thanks, Ben. Thanks, Ben. Thanks, Butch. Thanks for listening, folks. We'll be back next week where we'll be getting stuck into the high performance review. Podcast Network.